again, Mike O'Connor. This is another in the ongoing series of Geezer Casts. And the song in the background is the first actual song that I've made with Jamsticks. I've been having a great time with this sort of automated drumming program, and sort of that combined with getting some synthesizer sequencer software that actually works. I started to get back into it, so I'm pretty rusty, but it's getting there. Anyway, this is a song that is loosely based on an old blues tune called Sweet Home Chicago, but because of my recent experience with music licensing, I decided I would call it something else. It's not that close, and I'm sure that nobody will care, but I dedicated this one to Richard. Richard plays this one a lot. He doesn't play it this style. This is the big band version of Sweet Home Chicago called Richard's Sweet Home, in which I'm going a little bit over the top on the brass section, but I'm having a pretty good time nonetheless. I was going to sort of tone the brass down a little bit, but Danny Hansen came by. It's hunting season this week in Wisconsin. Danny's one of my neighbors, and he hunts on our place, and tomorrow's his big day, so we were talking about where the deer are, and I was encouraging him, as I always do, to bring helicopters with twin 50 caliber machine guns over and mow them all down. He was a little skeptical. He thought maybe that the DNR wouldn't have a whole lot of enthusiasm for that idea. But I think he'll do his best. Danny and Brad share the place, take alternating days. Whoever gets the first day always gets the most deer. So this is Danny's year. He's pretty excited about that. Anyway, it's a big week on the political front. I'm sure 50 years from now, when you, my unborn grandchildren, are listening to this show, that at some point or another, there will be sort of an inflection point where it became clear that we were going to get out of Iraq, which is the war that's been bugging us a lot recently. And this might be the week. Last week was pretty good because we had a lot of elections in which the voters voted what the polls have been saying all along, which is, you know, most of us aren't real keen on this war, and we're not terribly keen on politicians that support it, and we got rid of a bunch of them. I think that's good. And this week, one of those politicians, a guy named Murtha, stood up in the House and I think did a great job. I went out and read his resolution, calling for as quick as possible, as practical, a pullout of American troops in Iraq, for which he got roundly beat up, actually in quite outrageous terms by the Republicans. Outrageous enough that even the president and the vice president have started backing down on that now, which I think is only appropriate. And one of the big advantages that having a guy like Murtha do this is Murtha's is a pretty strong supporter of the military and a very decorated military guy himself. You know, it sort of epitomizes all that's good about the American military. And he's pretty unassailable. The Republicans weren't at their best this week, so that was good. I'm hoping that eventually we'll sort of get to the place where the country wants to be. And in keeping with that, I thought I'd do a little more poll watching on pollingreport.com. This week, they've got one up there that says, just your best guess, do you think U.S. troops or government officials have or have not tortured prisoners in Iraq or other countries? And 74% of us think they have, 20% think they have not, which is pretty reprehensible, I think. And I bet if you polled us, most of us would say that's pretty disgusting, but that's not what the poll was all about. course, again this week on Polling Report, there's another iteration of the approve-disapprove poll on how George Bush is handling his job as president. And he's continuing to crater. The trend line is pretty much downward and to the right on that one. It's down into the, something on the order of 60% of Americans disapprove of how he's doing his job. I was a little early on that. Even at its low, 10% of us disapproved. That was right after 9/11 back in 2001. I was in that 10%. I haven't changed my opinion. NBC had a pretty interesting poll this week. They had a poll that said, are there any candidates on the list for whom you would definitely not vote? And it's too bad. 19% of Republicans said they would definitely would not vote for John McCain. Just too bad. I like him. 8% of Republicans wouldn't vote for Giuliani. I think Giuliani'd be okay as a president. He's not a Democrat, and I'd rather have a Democrat in there, but I think Giuliani's all right. And the highest one on the Republican side was a guy named Gingrich, who way back in the old days was in the House. He was Speaker of the House, very influential guy. Eventually got brought down, but very articulate, very smart, influential guy, and 21% of Republicans definitely would not vote for him, which is too bad, because although I don't agree with him much, he is a whole lot smarter than the guy we've got in there now. On the Democrat side, 17% of us, including me, would not vote for Al Gore, and 14% would definitely not vote for John Kerry. I'm in favor. I'm against both of those guys myself. I'd vote for Hillary Clinton, I think, but 13% of Democrats say they definitely wouldn't. And John Edwards is way down at the bottom of the list, so I have a feeling his run for president's going to be in pretty good shape. I think it'd be a tough call between Giuliani and Edwards. It'd be a hard choice for me. I'd probably vote for Giuliani Edwards because he's a Democrat, but I think they're both pretty good guys. So anyway, that's sort of the poll roundup of the week for those of you in the year 2055 wondering what it's like here in America. It's pretty confused at the moment. We're really in a bad spot. We're sort of in the spot, not unlike sort of the depths of the Vietnam War era. There's a lot of very angry people, angry at each other. Not much in the way of middle ground, and not very many good choices. And the polls reflect it. Okay, what else we got here? Why can't I do that? Oh, it's caps lock. That's why I'm sitting here trying to toggle around to some of the other stuff I wanted to talk about. One of the things I wanted to talk about is something really cool that happened this week. Son Richard's up at Northland College, several hundred miles away, and he does a radio show on Saturday afternoons. And in the year 2055, this will be, of course, totally ho-hum, but for me, I was sort of reflecting on how remarkable it is to be able to listen to his radio show here many miles beyond the radius of the station, because they stream the show across the internet. And I was just sort of struck by how different that is from when I started doing radio back in the 60s. And how different it'll be for you in 2055. Clearly, by that time, it's not clear to me that radio stations will be... I suppose they'll still be there because we'll still need sort of the mobile form of audio entertainment for people who are in whatever transportation vehicles you're using. I don't know if there's still cars. I imagine by then the internal combustion engine doesn't probably work real well because the gasoline for it would be incredibly expensive. But some sort of personal vehicle, and depending on the kind of personal vehicles that you had, you might be on the internet all the time, in which case I can't imagine why you'd need radio at all. But right now, it's pretty cool to be able to listen to a radio show hundreds of miles away and then call him back on the internet-based phone, the Vonage phone, for essentially zero incremental cost. It's not for free, but it's no incremental cost of the call. So I called him a few times trying to get free tickets to the big school play that's going on. He wouldn't give them to me, you know. He had two free tickets to give away, and in his second show, he never gave them away, and he never gave them to me either. And I was like, well, how do you like that? Anyway, pretty neat way to sort of stay in touch with people, keep up with what's going on. I think that's pretty nifty. I imagine by 2055, one of the thoughts that struck me this week is that I have a terrible name for Google. I mean, it's a fine name for most things. Michael Connor, it's, you know, good utilitarian name, no problem. But there are a lot of Michael Connors out there. I was thinking that probably by the time you're listening to this, you'll be naming your kids in slightly unusual ways so that it'll be easy to find people on the internet. Part of what triggered this is I have a friend named Larry Gates, who you think, well, that's a pretty common name, except that Larry's first name is spelled L-E-A-R-Y, and he's the only one. And I was going, oh, man, is that handy or what? Have a name that you're the only hit on Google? That would be pretty nifty. And I was thinking, you know, when Richard and Robert were born, it was long before the internet was a going thing, and so it never even occurred to me to name them in such a way that it would be easy to find them on the net, but I bet people are thinking about that now, and I bet by 2055 there's some mechanism that makes it easy. Or maybe we just have a lot of really unusual names out there. Anyway, that's the kind of a cool thought. I couldn't come up with any good names. I kept coming up with stupid stuff like Mike and then some stupid noun like pickles. And, you know, I was like, nah, I don't think so. But maybe an unusual spelling. Who knows? Well, then the last thing I came across this week is I came a great site and a guy that shares my view that there's a group of folks called audiophiles who are just completely over the top when it comes to stereo equipment. And again, the stereo equipment now compared to the stereo equipment when I was first buying my very first amplifier back in, I think, 1961. When I bought my very first one. And the specifications for the gear today are so amazing compared to then that the audiophiles of yesteryear would, you know, there's no way that you could buy the kind of equipment that you can buy today at even at the bottom end. But, you know, an audiophile is, I think, by definition, a person who buys the most expensive stuff at any given moment in time. And this guy has this great site where he puts some of the most over-the-top stuff up on his site. And so I just thought I'd describe some of them to you. The first one that he's got on his site is called the Marengo Labs Signature 3D Mat. And you know, you go and you look at these. Yeah, I'm just going to click on it. It's basically a mat. You know, it's just a circle of, it looks like felt, and it's got little triangles cut out of it and a little hole in the middle, sort of, I suppose, so that you know where to center it. And these triangles get the least significant bits that get lost and never get off the disk. So these mats create a very specific energy spectra that mechanically dithers the laser. Now, I don't. The guy that wrote the site then said, I can only imagine that by mechanically dither, they mean wobble. So your CD player laser made wobbly by a mysterious energy spectra. Who could ask for more? And you think, I could get some of that. Ka-ching, $200. $200 for, I think, a felt mat to hold your laser disc. Pretty cool. Now, one of the things that has always really bugged me, and it's clearly bugging this guy too, is the mythology about speaker cables. I imagine in 2055 there will be some much more elegant way to make audio happen. But in these days, the way you make audio is you take a couple of cables and you hook them up to an analog amplifier on one end, and you hook them up to a speaker on the other, which is essentially a magnet that drives a cone back and forth. And there's a huge debate about whether the actual kind of cable that you use makes any kind of difference at all. And I'm of the opinion that any difference that the cable makes is so small that it's inaudible. And of course, this makes people who sell expensive speaker cables really cranky. And one of those people turned out to be a friend of Richard's named Bobby, who worked at Best Buy, which is a big box store that sells electronic technology stuff. And Bobby was had definitely drunk the high-end cable Kool-Aid and believed that better cables make better sound. And so I thought, you know, this might go out to Bobby. Bobby, you may not know about these, but you might want to take a look at MIT Oracle cables. This is a $9,000 speaker cable. And this guy's site says, apparently these cables measure well in, quote, articulation response, unquote, and balance the holy trinity of electrical properties. And the guy goes on to say, I would certainly expect my cables to measure well for $9,000, even in ways which no one has ever heard before, like these. But I'm not sure I'd even pay that kind of money for the Holy Trinity, all three of them in one room. And make sure you allow ample, quote, ample break-in time, should you be stupid enough to actually buy them. This guy goes on to say a little bit later in the site that one of the things that you should always be suspicious of is speaker cables that require, quote, break-in time. Because, folks, it's just copper or silver or gold or platinum or something. They can't need break-in time. So that was a good one. But then there's more in the speaker department. Opus MM speaker cables. These cables cost $30,750 for a pair. And I'm here to tell you that's a lot of money for anything, never mind speaker cables. That's definitely the over-the-top speaker cable category. And then the last one is a Altman acoustic panel. You go out to their site and you get a picture of a piece of wood. And it's really nice wood. I mean, I'm a woodworker type guy. And, you know, it looks like, I don't know, nice, maybe curly maple. It's got, or bird's eye maple. It's got lots of little knots in it, you know. And it's got wall mounting hardware, pre-drilled holes. Oh, no, it says here it's spruce. Sorry. There you go. And it's treated on both sides with a special blend of all natural ingredients, among a variety of oils and resins and fossil amber. So, you know, this is a piece of wood that's, let's see how big it is. It looks like it's about 2 by 4 feet. It doesn't come right to mind. Oh, here it is, 80 by 50 centimeters. 80 by 50 centimeters for a plank of wood. How much do you think you'd pay for an 80 by 50 centimeter plank of wood? Well, let's see, centimeters. I'm going to convert centimeters to meters to... Well, let's see, how many centimeters in a... It's like 0.8 meters, so that's like... well, you know, it's like 2.5 feet wide by maybe 1.5 feet. So, you know, how much would you pay for that? Well, it turns out that this is audiophile wood. And so you can have this piece of wood that's made out of... you know, all natural stuff for $200. $240. Again, I think this is great. It's sort of madness. It's completely beyond the realm of fiscal rationality. And interestingly enough, when you go to the site, it says that they're completely sold out. So somebody thinks this stuff's really good. And so anyway, that's my ludicrous audiophile thing of the week. If you are my unborn grandchildren living in the year 2055, I sure as heck hope that you conserve your resources and spend your money on something else. That wraps up this week's GeezerCast. I'll let my version of Richard Sweetholm, doesn't have anything to do with Chicago, for those of you who are listening from a licensing standpoint, let that take us out, and I'll see you the next time.